Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Yeah, he followed it kind of bad way.
Visit the Plymouth Plantation in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and you may feel as though you've been transported back to the year 1627. It's a living history museum, a village of thatched roofed houses, blacksmith shops, and neatly fenced gardens, inhabited by what they call colonial interpreters, former school teachers, actors, and just plain history buffs who spend their workdays living the 17th century New England life and answering the questions of curious students, children, and tourists. The interpreters dress in 17th century clothing and work with its tools. They also profess the attitudes and beliefs of the time, from ideas of science and religion to their presumptions about America's indigenous people, whom they called Indians. William Rutter is a colonial interpreter who plays the part of the writer Edward Winslow at Plymouth Plantation. Here's what he says about his Native American neighbors.
I find them to be the most curious sort here, and quite remarkable. I've never seen anything like it in my life. People live so poorly and so crudely. I've seen poor men in London, and yet to come here and see these poor folks, they have no art or science nor industry. The ones that live closest by to us, they've sworn an allegiance to our king, and they seem to hold that quite profitably, for we will conduct no business with those that shall not swear an allegiance to our king. I hope by our example in planting ourselves here that we can set better order to this country.
The plantation's stockaded village is as faithful to 17th century pilgrim life as historical scholarship can make it, yet outside the walls and down the path a bit, you'll find a very different Plymouth, another exhibit called Hobomok's Home Site. Hobomok, a Poconoket Indian, acted as guide and interpreter between Native Americans and the newly arrived pilgrims. At his reconstructed home site, you'll find real Native Americans, mostly Wampanoag, also dressed in period garb and answering the same questions from the same curious visitors. As you might guess, all the exhibits at Plymouth Plantation are extremely popular during the Thanksgiving season. Just a stone's throw from the legendary Plymouth Rock, it's a living corroboration of the way history books and pop culture depict the origins of Thanksgiving today. But for the Native Americans here, the Plymouth Plantation, especially during the Thanksgiving season, is also a memorial to the history that many have forgotten, their history. The coming of the pilgrims with their settlements and their Thanksgivings means no new beginning to them, but instead a painful and murderous end. Jonathan Perry is Nequina Wampanoag, who coordinates the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at the Plymouth Plantation.
I think it stems from what colonization is about. Cultures coming into a place, establishing their cultures, their belief systems, and forcing the indigenous inhabitants of that place to adhere to that system that they're bringing in. And any reminder of those pre-existing cultures is a reminder that the colonizing force does not truly belong to that place, or there is history beyond that colonizing force. People would be uncomfortable with dealing with the fact that this country is built on oppression, it's built on genocide, it's built on these sort of uncomfortable historic instances that cause the demise of millions of people so that people can be in the place that they are in right now.
Why is one story nearly ignored and another reverently repeated each November? You might get 100 different answers to that question, depending on who you ask. Yet as many Americans sit down for a big meal on the last Thursday of November, Native Americans, especially in New England, gather for a National Day of Mourning. For them, the Thanksgiving story is a grotesque misinterpretation of Native history, rewritten to suit the needs of white apologists for European colonialism. Coming up on Storylines New England, we explore the early relations between New England's indigenous people and white European colonists through the pages of two very different books, one by a Native man, the other by a Puritan woman. Once again, Jonathan Perry.
There were times when the English celebrated the answered prayers of the demise of Native nations and had celebrations because sometimes hundreds of people were killed. And that was seen as a good thing and therefore celebrated. and a celebration that has come in part as a result of those events is a painful memory and a reminder of the history and the problems that we are still faced with as a people today. I mean, we're just still trying to overcome oppression. We're still trying to repair our nations from mass cultural genocide.
From the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. Storylines is a special 13-part radio project of the American Library Association that looks at the literature of New England as a way to better understand who we are as New Englanders and Americans. So far, we've read from the works of Robert Frost, Grace Metalius, and Mark Twain, to name a few, and looked at some of the issues these works raise, from our region's political influence to the struggles of New England's small towns. Our goal? To gain a better understanding of where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. This week on Storylines, we turn to the Native American experience in New England with William Epps's A Son of the Forest and Other Writings and The Sovereignty and Goodness of God by Mary White Rowlandson.
Mary White's family arrived in the New World in 1639, when she was 2 or 3 years old. The Whites were part of what was called the Great Migration, a huge influx of English settlers who emigrated to New England for a variety of reasons. Some came for religious freedom, others to avoid persecution, and others, like the farming Whites, came for better opportunities to own land and live prosperously. They finally settled in a small north-central Massachusetts town called Lancaster, on the fringes of the Anglo-Indian frontier. Mary White eventually married well to a man named Rowlandson, the town's Puritan minister, and she assumed a role of relative prominence in her community.
Yet the relations between European settlers and Native Americans had been growing increasingly tense for some time. And in 1675, when Mary Rowlandson was nearly 40 and a mother of 3 children, they reached a boiling point. Very quickly, a war initiated by the Wampanoag Sachem Metacom, known to the English as King Philip, turned the frontier into a bloody battleground. In her book, Mary Rowlandson described the attack on Lancaster, a raid that resulted in the capture of herself and her children and the complete destruction of her small community.
On the 10th of February, 1675, came the Indians with great numbers upon Lancaster. Their first coming was about sunrising. Hearing the noise of some guns, we looked out. Several houses were burning, and the smoke ascending to heaven. There were 5 persons taken in one house, the father and the mother and a sucking child they knocked on the head. The other 2 they took and carried away alive. There were 2 others, who being out of their garrison upon some occasion, were set upon. One was knocked on the head, the other escaped. Another there was, who, running along, was shot and wounded and fell down. He begged of them his life, promising them money, as they told me. But they would not hearken to him, but knocked him in head, and stripped him naked, and split open his bowels. At length they came and beset our own house, and quickly it was the dolefulest day that ever mine eyes saw.
Rowlandson's captivity lasted about 3 months. She was ransomed for the sum of £20, and in 1682 published a narrative of her experiences called The Sovereignty and Goodness of God. The book was an instant success, America's first bestseller. It launched an enormously popular literary genre, the captivity narrative. But perhaps more importantly, it profoundly affected the way Europeans thought about America's indigenous people, particularly in the context of King Philip's War, the bloodiest conflict per capita in American history. Rowlandson's utterly one-sided characterization of Indians as loathsome heathens without mercy or conscience enjoyed a long, uncontradicted life until 1837, when a Pequot native named William Epps tried to set the record straight.
Epps was a Methodist minister and the author of A Son of the Forest, the first autobiography by a Native American and the first book to describe white-Indian relations from an Indian's point of view. Epps's trials with white America, from an abused childhood and indentured servitude to his involvement in the French and Indian War and his conversion to Methodism, are searingly described. And although A Son of the Forest never achieved the popularity of Rowlandson's narrative, it opened the door for Epps to write and speak out about the history of atrocities, hypocrisies, and misinterpretations that have permanently dogged Anglo-Native relations.
Who is to account for those destructions upon innocent families and helpless children? It was said by some of the New England writers that living babies were found at the breasts of their dead mothers. What an awful sight! And to think, too, that these diseases were carried among them on purpose to destroy them. Let the children of the pilgrims blush, while the son of the forest drops a tear and groans over the fate of his murdered and departed fathers. Oh, Christians, can you answer for those beings that have been destroyed by your hostilities, and beings, too, that lie endeared to God as yourselves, his son being their savior as well as yours, and alike to all men? And will you presume to say that you are executing the judgments of God by so doing, or as many really are approving the works of their father to be genuine, as it is certain that every time they celebrate the day of the pilgrims they do?
Today on Storylines New England, we're looking at the way we've told, retold, and remembered the Native American experience in our region through two books, Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God and A Son of the Forest and Other Writings by William Epps. And we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. How much do you know about our region's Native American experience and its history? Why do you think that Americans seem so willing to ignore the Native American side of their own history? Native Americans, you call us too and tell us your story and your family's story. What are your frustrations with the way history is written and remembered? What are the struggles you've faced preserving your history and your identity? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
Joining us for the hour is Linda Coombs. She joins us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Linda is an Aquinnah Wampanoag and Associate Director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation. Linda Coombs, good to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Joining us from Charlestown, Rhode Island, Tall Oak, an absentee Mashantucket Pequot Wampanoag. And Tall Oak, it's good to have you too. Thanks again for the time.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm going to start with you, Tall Oak. Let's start with the William Epps book and also the Rowlandson book. How do these works help us understand the history of this relationship between the two peoples here in New England?
Well, the thing that I have stands out in my mind more than anything about William Epps' book is that all of his collected works, it's remarkable to have a voice of a Native person that we can go to that tells you what went on in his mind, how he felt about what he experienced. And you could read about those experiences from the non-Indian point of view with no problem, because all of the images that have been generated about our people since 1492 have been generated from people outside of our community, the people who came here. So they're only from that perspective. So his work is extremely valuable because it gives you the insights into how our people related to what was happening. And you get the feelings that are deep down inside that no non-Indian could ever really understand or probably even cared to write about.
Mm. Now, I know you're less familiar with the Rowlandson book, but somewhat familiar with that. How about that, Tall Oak? How does that sort of provide context or explain the history of this relationship?
Well, I had read all of Mary Rowlandson's Captivity when I was in my 20s, and I haven't lost most of it because history that I delve into, and history is my passion, that has to do with New England, they always have to quote Mary Rowlandson.
Right, right. In fact, Epps quotes her in his book.
What's that?
Epps even quotes her in his book.
Oh, yeah, because it's essential to the process, because she wrote in detail at the time about what was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, Tall Oak, how This particular subject teaches us so much about whose voice it is we're hearing when it comes to any aspect of history. And as you pointed out, the emergence of Epps's voice in the early 19th century filled a gap that had been sitting for quite a long time. But Linda Coombs, I want to ask you something about image and who controls the kinds of things we remember, because, of course, we've just gotten through Thanksgiving and all that imagery of the helpful Indians coming out of the forest to assist the reverent pilgrims with their first Thanksgiving, and all those pictures and all that talk about them sitting down together to dine at that very first Thanksgiving at Plymouth. Tell us something about the accuracy of that image in real historical terms.
It's not accurate at all. It is true that the pilgrims did hold a first harvest celebration to which Massasoit and 90 men at least attended. And I think the similarity with truth kind of ends there. The rest of it is largely mythological. And, you know, the actual events, you know, of that time, you know, just have been omitted.
Mm-hmm. Tall Oak, is it possible for us to know anything about what the attitudes of Native Americans were to the pilgrims when they first landed on the shore and had such a terrible time even surviving through their first couple of winters?
Since there's nothing that's been written from our own point of view at that time period, we have to rely on the historical record. But what I do when I look through the records that have all been kept by non-Indians, I read them all with what I call my Indian sifter, because I have to sift through all of those things that are just completely, totally saturated with nothing but bias and bigotry and all kinds of hatred that reaches a level that's toxic. And you have to really understand that when you read those things, because if people don't and they read those terrible things and they take them literally as being the truth, they just continue to perpetuate the injustice of the past.
You know, Linda, you called the Thanksgiving image a mythology. Who created that mythology, and when, and why?
Actually, the mythology is really a 19th century creation. Alexander Young was rewriting the works of Mort. There's a book called Mort's Relations from 1621. And we're not really sure who Mort is. He could have been more than one person. It was just sort of a pen name. And Mort's relation is like a letter or a series of letters back to England. And in amongst many other topics that he was writing on, he included a description of the 1621 harvest feast to which Massasoit and 90 men came. 200 years later, Alexander Young rewrote it, took out the one piece about Massasoit and the 90 men coming to Plymouth, it made a separate paragraph of it, therefore highlighting it more. And in a footnote, Alexander Young referred to this as the first Thanksgiving, you know, with capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that point, I mean, you know, in 1621, neither the English nor the Wampanoags knew it was the first Thanksgiving. They were attending, and we're not even sure why, the harvest feast of the English.
Linda, is it at all accurate to say that Native Americans gave some aid and comfort to pilgrims and other settlers in the very earliest years of their presence in New England?
They did have a treaty of mutual protection with Massasoit, who was from Poconoket, so they had that treaty with one village only, and also including, you know, any allies among the Wampanoag that Massasoit had. It was Squanto who showed them how to, you know, plant corn and with the fish and all of that, and help them with hunting and fishing and so on. Other than that, I'm not real sure if there's any other documentation about this type of help. I think it's just been elaborated on from certain events like Squanto.
I see. Well, you're listening to Storylines New England. I'm Kevin Gardner, along with Laura Canoy, and today we're talking about New England's Native Americans. We're looking at their story through two books written very early in our history, the Puritan Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God, about her capture by Native Americans during King Philip's War, and William Epps's A Son of the Forest and Other Writings, the very first autobiography written by a Native American. And Tall Oak, we know that whatever the relations of European settlers and Native Americans were in the very earliest days of settlement, they certainly deteriorated by the time we got up to the 1670s, when we had the devastating conflict that now goes by the somewhat inaccurate name King Philip's War. Can you tell us something about what it was that caused relations between white settlers and Native Americans to deteriorate so badly over the course of about 50 years that the bloodiest war in American history broke out in 1675?
Well, Linda, just a few minutes ago, mentioned the Treaty of Peace and Friendship, quote-unquote, between the Wampanoags and the Pilgrims. But actually, if you look at the terms of the treaty, it was more to the advantage of the English in because it didn't really recognize and respect the rights of the Wampanoag people. That was the beginning of the problem right there, mm-hmm. as it was spelled out in the initial stages of their interaction. But everything that the Wampanoag people did was based on our traditions that we followed, which taught us that everything we had was a gift from the Creator. So with the acceptance of a gift, there was always the obligation to share. So sharing and respect were always part of our tradition. The problems came about when we were confronted with a people who didn't have such a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
They had an opposite tradition because injustice and disrespect was what Europe was hemorrhaging from at the time when the Pilgrims left there to come here. So you have put those two things together, and it's easy to see how there would have to be some kind of conflict eventually because respect has to be mutual to work.
So, Tall Oak, was it was it about diminishing resources, economics, not to sound like a kindergartner, but, you know, not sharing?
Well, diminishing resources, I don't think, became a major issue at that early stage.
Uh-huh.
That was only 55 years after Massasoit had met the Pilgrims in Friendship that the war erupted. But it was a combination of one injustice after another that led Philip to declare that he would choose to die on his feet rather than live on his knees at the hands of the English, because that's basically what was expected of Indian people, to give in completely and to do everything that they were told by a series of laws that were imposed upon them that we still live with today, laws that are unjust because they didn't respect our people and our way of life. And they were transplanted alien laws that were brought here from England. We still live under English law. My wife and I, we just lost land on November the 5th in the Massachusetts Land Court because of this unjust law that we still live under.
Mm. You know, what's so wonderful about the Rowlandson book and the Epps book that we're talking about today on Storylines in New England, The Sovereignty and Goodness of God by Rowlandson and A Son of the Forest by William Epps, is the way that both of them describe King Philip's War and the way that they educate us about King Philip's War, a war that, you know, many Americans really have no idea what it was all about, no idea that it was so bloody, one of the deadliest, you know, per capita in American history. I think most people would say the Civil War. They wouldn't say King Philip's War. We'd like to play a reading now from both books. And what we've done with these readings is juxtapose statements from Rowlandson and Epps, where they both describe King Philip's War from their very two different perspectives. Let's hear that.
Their first coming was about sunrising. Hearing the noise of some guns, we looked out. Several houses were burning, and the smoke ascending to heaven.
It must be recollected that this war was legally declared by Philip, so that the colonies had a fair warning.
Thus these murderous wretches went on, burning and destroying before them.
It was no savage war of surprise, as some suppose, but one sorely provoked by the Pilgrims themselves.
Thus were we butchered by those merciless heathen, standing amazed with the blood running down to our heels.
It is said that 700 of the Narragansetts perished. the greatest part of them being women and children.
The bullets flying thick. One went through my side, and the same as would seem through the bowels and hand of my dear child in my arms.
But the most horrid act was in taking Philip's son, about 10 years of age, and selling him to be a slave away from his father and mother.
There was another Indian, so wicked and cruel as to wear a string about his neck, strung with Christian's fingers.
I can hardly restrain my feelings to think that a people calling themselves Christians could conduct so scandalous, so outrageous, making themselves appear so despicable in the eyes of the Indians.
Readings from William Epps's A Son of the Forest, he was a Pequot Indian, and from Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God. Those are the books that we're talking about today on Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with my co-host Kevin Gardner, and our guest today, Linda Coombs and Tall Oak. Linda Coombs is an Akwena Wampanoag, and Tall Oak is an absentee Mashantucket Pequot Wampanoag. And Linda Coombs, I want to bring you into this, and I also want to bring our listeners in. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here on Storylines New England. 1-800-892-6477. Linda, just give us your feelings when you heard that reading, those very striking, strikingly different interpretations of King Philip's War. What does that sort of evoke to you or say to you, hearing those two completely different takes on this?
Well, I think that, you know, I have to kind of go back to the, what for me is the bottom line. And that's that when the English came here, and they just came here and just settled. There was no prior negotiation with any of our leaders or anything like that to avail themselves of the land in Patuxet, which then became Plymouth, and then when they spread out from there. And then, even though there was the treaty that Tall Oak and I both have mentioned, the English, right from the beginning, they were violating the the points of that treaty. And that's something that a lot of people don't understand. They think there were 50 years of peace. There was not 50 years of peace. There was 50 years of just going back and forth. And from my knowledge of it, it was like 50 years of us just reacting to what they were doing and trying to maintain our own lives and dealing with these profound, devastating changes like the loss of life and the plagues and that sort of thing, and the changes that the English were trying to bring about, because they were already imposing their laws, English education, the government structure, everything on us. And while, war is a horrible and, ugly thing, there's a lot behind it that people just don't know about.
And that's, again, what's so great about these books is they're telling us about this 50 years where people think it was 50 years of nothing happening. But what you're saying, Linda, is there was a lot going on.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Tons.
Well, coming up after a break, more on the New England Native American experience and how we've remembered, retold, and recognized it through the pages of William Epps's A Son of the Forest and other writings, and The Sovereignty and Goodness of God by Mary Rowlandson. We'll also start taking your calls, so stay with us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
For more information on Storylines New England or the books that we're reading, visit our website, storyline.ala.org, or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Kanoy. You're listening to Storylines New England.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Kanoy.
And I'm Kevin Gardner. Each week on Storylines, we look at a particular New England author's work as a way to try and better understand ourselves as New Englanders, where we've been, where we are, and where we're heading. Today we're looking at two different takes on the Native American experience in New England and how history has remembered or forgotten each. Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God was our country's first published captivity narrative. It's the story of her experiences during the brutal King Philip's War, when she was held captive by natives for 3 months, while William Epps's A Son of the Forest and other writings was the first autobiography of a Native American.
Epps's writings and speeches recognized the atrocities and hypocrisies committed by colonists in the New World and defended the actions of Native Americans during King Philip's War and later. It's a side of the Native experience that's often ignored or misrepresented by history books, by pop culture, and in family stories. The two books stand in stark contrast to each other in many ways, perhaps most profoundly in their characterizations of the identities and motivations of Native Americans, and in their views of God and the workings of God's will. Mary Rowlandson, a devout Puritan, understands her experience as a divine test and as a lesson on the powerlessness of men and the grace of a God who is unmistakably allied with the Puritans and against the heathen, cruel Indians.
Another thing that I would observe is the strange providence of God in turning things about when the Indians were at the highest and the English at the lowest. I was with the enemy 11 weeks and 5 days, and not 1 week passed without the fury of the enemy and some desolation by fire and sword upon one place or other. They mourned with their black faces for their own losses, yet triumphed and rejoiced in their inhumane and many times devilish cruelty to the English. They would boast much of their victories, saying that in 2 hours' time they had destroyed such a captain and his company at such a place, and such a captain and his company in such a place, and such a captain and his company in such a place, and boast how many towns they had destroyed, and then scoff and say they had done them a good turn to send them to heaven so soon.
William Epps's writings speak often of God as well, but his recollections of conversion and his understanding of Christian faith are turned to a different purpose, to expose the lies and hypocrisies that Puritans and others had preached through writers such as Rowlandson for more than a century.
Now let me ask you, white man, if it is a disgrace for to eat, drink, and sleep with the image of God, or sit, or walk, or talk with them, or have you the folly to think that the white man, being 1 in 15 or 16, are the only beloved images of God? Assemble all nations together in your imagination, and then let the whites be seated among them. And then let us look for the whites. And I doubt not it would be hard finding them. For to the rest of the nations they are still but a handful. Now suppose these skins were put together, and each skin had its national crimes written upon it. Which skin do you think would have the greatest? I will ask one question more. Can you charge the Indians with robbing a nation, almost of their whole continent, and murdering their women and children, and then depriving the remainder of their lawful rights that nature and God required them to have? And to cap the climax, rob another nation to till their grounds and welter out their days with hunger and fatigue under the scorching rays of a burning sun? I should look at all the skins, and I know that when I cast my eye upon that white skin, and if I saw those crimes written upon it, I should enter my protest against it immediately and cleave to that which is more honorable.
Yet, interpreting God's intentions is just one of many areas where these two authors, and the people they represent, struggle for control of the way history is understood. Today in Storylines New England, we're looking at these two very different books by New England authors that regard Native American and white European interactions so differently, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. What were you told about the history of New England's Native Americans? How did you discover their real story? And if you are of Native descent, how do you feel your story is being told today? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477.
And we're joined today from Mashpee, Massachusetts, by Linda Coombs, an Aquinnah Wampanoag and Associate Director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation, and from Charlestown, Rhode Island, Tall Oak, an absentee Mashantucket Pequot Wampanoag. And Tall Oak, this is in so many ways, from King Philip's War forward, a contest for meaning, a contest for the way that the story of both peoples is told and who gets to tell that story. Now, William Epps's autobiography, A Son of the Forest, appeared in 1831, I believe, almost 150, a little over 150 years after King Philip's War was allegedly complete, over and done with. How did the appearance of that autobiography affect the way New Englanders perceived Native Americans at the time?
Well, I think at that time period, if you remember the rest of America's history, what was taking place was actually a proof that America has learned nothing from its past, because at that time period is when they were attacking the Seminoles in mm-hmm. Florida, invading their lands, and preparing for the Indian removal, which took place in the time of William Epps, when they had the move to take all Indians east of the Mississippi and drive them westward, because we weren't supposed to have any of the land that the Creator gave us. That was the ultimate plan mm-hmm. from the very start. And what we have to do is connect all these dots in order to make history relevant, to see how it connects with today. And every time I see another real estate sign, I'm reminded about why our people had to be burned alive, even our little babies, so beautiful and innocent, as William Epps spoke of. And all those terrible things had to be done, and the history of America had to be written in our blood. And William Epps realized more than anyone that the story of America is a story, essentially, of injustice, and that injustice always has two major components. It has a victim and it has a beneficiary. And we, of course, have known for many years who the victims were, but today, now, as we look at William Epps' work and other things that have come to light, we need to realize and have acknowledgement from those who are the beneficiaries if there's to be any meaningful changes or lessons learned from this.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting what you say, Tall Oak, about looking at William Epps today. I was struck by his continual use of the words people of color. You know, that's mm-hmm. so contemporary. People talk like that now.
Right. He was way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Right. Let's take some calls, both of you. Again, the number here on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Tall Oak and Linda Coombs. We're talking about the Native American experience here in New England on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. To Wakefield, Vermont first, and Jan is joining us. Hi, Jan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a couple of comments and a question. And I studied King Philip's War at great length during a few years ago when I had a Abenaki teacher. And but before I mention that, one really wonderful thing that she taught us was that, in fact, the Indians of this Indian people in this area practiced five major Thanksgivings. And to think of it as being, you know, that there's this myth of a Thanksgiving is, I mean, it's a myth in more than one way, that there was a Thanksgiving feast for maple syrup harvest, for strawberry harvest, for bean harvest, for corn harvest, and again, for squash. And that that Thanksgiving was, and that was a part of daily life. And I think it's important to remember that.
Mm.
It's a gift, it's a spiritual teaching from a people that, you know, if we started honoring some more of the spiritual traditions of the people of the land, we'd all be healthier and our culture would be stronger. But the other thing I think is interesting, I think it would be especially illuminating, I mean, probably Linda and Tall Oak know more specifically about the particular laws that were passed just prior to the beginning of King Philip's War that were provocative. One I remember had to do with the length of canoes, that Indian people were prohibited from having canoes beyond a certain length, which made trading impossible for them, and also the possession of firearms was prohibited, which made hunting a certain, you know, the type of hunting they'd been doing
Linda Coombs, could you talk about, thanks for that point, Jane. Linda Coombs, could you talk about some of the laws, large and small, that were imposed on natives to make sure that they didn't prosper?
Well, specifically, oh my goodness, I mean,
where do you start, right?
Yeah. Like, pick one.
Right.
I know that some of them, you know, by the time of King Philip's War and for, you know, many years prior, we'd been, the term reservation wasn't used, but the concept was the same. It was either, you know, a reservation like state that we were, you know, put into land that no one else considered valuable. People were also organized into praying towns, which were, you know, villages of Christian Indians, people that had been converted. And the praying towns had, you know, very strict, you know, rules and laws that the native people were supposed to abide by. There were laws that were concerning the, you know, land transaction and that sort of thing. I really can't think of anything specifically.
Well, I think our caller raised some other good ones,
yes,
too, about the size of the canoes. I mean, that's really getting down into the details, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, it is that type of thing, and there were many like that about something as seemingly minute or, you know, as the length of a canoe, but it had, you know, as she has stated, it had, you know, great effects on us, and in our very daily living, it affected us.
Well, it's pretty clear that this was something, Linda, of the kind of death of a thousand cuts cause of the war, even though the proximate cause, the immediate cause, was, of course, the hanging of the three Indians who had apparently or were accused of murdering John Sassaman, the praying Indian. But we've got a raft of phones here, and we need to take another call. So let's hear from Barry from Georgia, Vermont. Hi, Barry. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for this interesting show tonight. I used to teach Mary Rowlandson's narrative of captivity when I taught high school,
mm-hmm,
here in Vermont. I was always, what I always found most interesting about narrative of captivity is its insight into the Calvinist mind, how a person of that era in that upbringing dealt with personal horror. It's kind of horrific from a certain point of view that this is all translated as interpreted as a testimony to the sovereignty and goodness of God. From that perspective, makes you feel a bit desperate, I think, in regard to our ability to deal with these kind of realities without resorting to a supernatural interpretation. Of the sort that Mary Rowlandson retreats to in trying to understand what happened to her.
Well, I think there's no question, Barry, that Mary Rowlandson not only processes reality in a typically Puritan way, but that she actually goes out of her way to attribute actions or choices made by the Native Americans themselves, her captors, in a way that reflects, that is never allowed to reflect well on them, but rather only reflects on the power of God himself. In fact, we have just a quick reading that really speaks to that. And we have Brenda Foley here reading just a little bit of Mary Rowlandson's account about why she was not raped, but instead was released.
Oh, the wonderful power of God that I have seen and the experience that I have had. I have been in the midst of those roaring lions and savage bears that feared neither God nor man nor the devil, by night and day, alone and in company, sleeping all sorts together, and yet not one of them ever offered me the least abuse of unchastity to me in word or action. Though some are ready to say I speak it for my own credit, but I speak it in the presence of God, and to his glory. God's power is as great now, and as sufficient to save, as when he preserved Daniel in the lion's den, or the three children in the fiery furnace. I may well say as his psalm, O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth for ever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he hath redeemed from the hand of the enemy, especially that I should come away in the midst of so many hundreds of enemies, quietly and peaceably, and not a dog moving his tongue.
This is Storylines New England. I'm Laura Canoy along with Kevin Gardner, and that was a reading from one of the two books that we're talking about today on Storylines. That was from Puritan Mary Rowlandson's The Sovereignty and Goodness of God. It's about her capture by natives during King Philip's War. The other book that we're looking at is William Epps's A Son of the Forest and Other Writings. That was the first autobiography written by a Native American. Join us with your calls on Storylines New England, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are two members of Native New England tribes. They are Linda Coombs. She joins us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Linda is an Akwina Wampanoag and Associate Director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation. Joining us from Charlestown, Rhode Island, Tall Oak, and absentee Mashantucket Pequot Wampanoag. Join us again with your calls, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Let's go to Warwick, Massachusetts next. And Tricia joins us from there. Hi, Tricia. Go ahead.
I'm Patricia. I'm a Cherokee from Oklahoma originally.
Uh-huh.
And very recently, I grew up in the Oklahoma schools being taught the white version, even though I lived in the Cherokee Nation. But recently, I have gone back to a lot of the original documents of treaties and diaries of people in the Cherokee Nation. Obviously, this is nothing to do with the Wampanoag, and I really want to tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing right now.
Thank you.
But one of the things that has been, that I have noticed as a constant refrain, is that all of this was done by developers. They sold a bill of goods to the people coming to this country from England, telling them that they would be able to have huge amounts of land and become wealthy landowners, which was essentially the same thing as being a noble when you were an English person. And so the people came here expecting that this would be no problem at all. They didn't think of it as theft, which, of course, it was. But every time they took some land from a tribe, eventually there were more people who needed more land, and they wanted to sell more land because it gave them more money. And so it was they were telling people back in England at this point that Indians were animals just like deer and other herds that roamed wild in the forest.
It seems amazing to think about it today, Tricia. I'm so glad she called.
Yeah, the misrepresentations that were being made by speculators and others to potential immigrants in England itself, to say nothing of the political and religious upheavals that were occurring in that country, which I think Tall Oak mentioned before. But Tall Oak, our caller said something fascinating about her own education. I'm very curious, what kind of a bill of goods about Native American history were you sold when you were in school as a young boy?
I think we've all been victims of the same basic assembly line system of education where everyone comes out believing the same and is expected to comply, complete conformity to everything that you've been taught. And what happens in the process like this, where our heroes are not your heroes, is that you develop a negative self-image very easily. Mm-hmm. And when Native people develop that negative self-image because they were measured by a non-Indian yardstick, which still is being used against us today, that negative self-image is one of the things that helped to contribute so much to the use of alcohol, or the Indian exterminator, as I prefer to call it, because it's killed more Indians than any guns ever did. My own father was a victim. So there isn't a single Indian family that hasn't been touched by that. And a lot of that has to do with the type of educational system that we've been exposed to, and manipulation of the truth to create the desired effect, which the media still does. I mean, that's why we're over in Iraq now, because the media is going along with this whole process, which the society, the dominating society, follows, of manipulation of the truth, as Mary Rowlandson did with her manipulation of scriptures.
Well, nobody's more articulate about the effects of alcohol on Indian culture and Indian society than Epps is, of course, in his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Coombs, tell us about your early education. Did you experience the same sort of thing that Tall Oak did?
Yep, it was just about the same. I remember hearing about the pilgrims coming and Squanto and Thanksgiving, and that's it.
And what happened? When was the moment, and what was the revelation when you realized that there was a whole other hidden side to the history that you'd been hearing?
I don't think I actually, you know, thought much more about it until I was in my 20s and had begun working at Plymouth and began, you know, delving into the history more, you know, at that time.
Uh-huh.
But it's just so offensive and insulting to have the whole Wampanoag or, you know, any other Native nations just left out. And to have the, you know, what happened just manipulated for a purpose, because the omissions and the distortions, they do serve a purpose.
Linda, things have changed in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years in terms of the stories and how they're told. Do you think that they have changed enough in your mind?
No, not at all. I work a lot with teachers. And, you know, and I'm very grateful for them because they just are so open and flexible and want to hear the true history, even though it is a difficult one. But there's still so many other people that get defensive, or they don't want to hear it, or they think that they're being blamed, or, you know, take it personally or something. I don't know. But it is. It is something that this country needs to acknowledge and to grapple with.
Let's take another call. This one from Windsor, Vermont. Douglas joins us from there. Douglas, go ahead. Thanks for joining us on Storylines New England.
All right.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hello, good evening. I'm Douglas Hall, and I'm a direct descendant of Richard Warren, one of the pilgrims, and Richard's daughter Elizabeth married Richard Church, who was one of the military leaders in the King Philip War, one of the Puritan pilgrim leaders, and was actually in the final battle where King Philip was hunted down in that swampy area and killed, and the decimation of his body and so on and so forth. And I, as a descendant, certainly not proud of that. It's terrible, and what happened to his family. But were there any pilgrims or Puritans that were more sensitive to Native Americans and what was going on?
Do you know the answer to that, Tall Oak?
I think that in every generation there's always been those people like Roger Williams who were against the injustice to Native people and didn't subscribe to the concept that the Massachusetts Puritans did, that Christians, quote-unquote, had a right to heathen lands. And if it wasn't for those few people that have existed in every generation, all of us would have been burned alive, and we wouldn't be here now having this conversation, because that's how hell-bent the people were who came here, to destroy everything that we had and take it for their own, because the concept of sharing was not part of their tradition.
Well, Tall Oak, thank you for that, and Douglas, thank you also for that call. One final question for both of you, and I'll start with you, Linda. We've been focusing a lot on King Philip's War, again, how it's been told through these two books. But that war is almost 300 years old. Do you think, Linda, that it is still with us today?
Yes, I do. It's still with us because, you know, the actual facts, or as much as we can ascertain them of history, have not been dealt with and acknowledged for what they are. There's been, as I was just saying a moment ago, you know, the huge effort to stereotype, to dismiss, to, you know, omit, to distort, all of which serves a definite purpose. And as long as you have that type of thing going on, then history is still with us, whether people recognize that or not. And it will always be until it is honestly, you know, acknowledged for what happened.
What do you think, Tall Oak? How King Philip's War, again, almost 300 years old, is still with us today?
I think that last word that Linda said is the key word that everyone that's listening and everyone in this country has to deal with, and that's the word acknowledgement. I think America can be best compared to an alcoholic. The because America has been in denial for over 500 years. And the first step in dealing with alcoholism in the way of getting a cure is to come to that first stage of acknowledgement. Acknowledge that you have the problem. As long as you remain in denial, nothing can be done about solving the problem. So we can't stress that enough, and I've spent all of my 68 years of my adult life, at least, trying to help have people understand the need for the acknowledgement so we can get on with the business of healing and reconciliation. But to have that happen before that takes place is further victimization of the victims.
Tall Oak, just very quickly, do you think the day will come when a balanced story can finally be told, when it will be accepted by people in New England and elsewhere?
I think that day has to come because it's mandatory to our common survival if we're to share the same space here, because it's too late to send anyone back anywhere. So if we're to share the space here on this earth and here in this hemisphere, we have to do that with the respect that was always central to the Indian way of life. All of man's problems come from going against the laws of nature and of nature's God, according to the traditions I was taught by an elder in my family. And you boil everything down, it goes back to that. If you have respect between individuals, between communities, between nations, then there really can be peace on earth. But you can never have peace without justice.
Well, Tall Oak, it has been great to have you on the program. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Tall Oak joined us from Charlestown, Rhode Island. He is an absentee Mashantucket Pequot Wampanoag. And Linda Coombs, I want to thank you, too, for your time.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Linda Coombs, an Aquinnah Wampanoag and Associate Director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation.
For more information about Storylines New England or the books in our series, visit our website at storylines.ala.org.
Storylines New England is produced by Keith Shields. Our engineer is Andrew Walsh. We had production help from Dan Colgan and Ty Fraley. Brenda Foley and Eric Peter Hodges performed our readings. Our library discussion guides were written by Bill Ott. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of Storylines America is Paul Zales. Storylines New England comes to you from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire. And we're going to end our program today with the words of William Epps, who, at the end of his eulogy for King Philip, makes a plea for whites and natives alike not to repeat the mistakes of the past. I'm Kevin Gardner.
And I'm Laura Canoy. Join us next week for Storylines New England.
Having now closed, I would now say many thanks is due from me to you, though an unworthy speaker, for your kind attention, and I wish you to understand that we are thankful for every favor, and you and I have to rejoice that we have not to answer for our father's crimes. Neither shall we do right to charge them one to another. We can only regret it and flee from it. And from henceforth let peace and righteousness be written upon our hearts and hands forever, is the wish of a poor Indian.
Storylines New England is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Next time on Storylines New England, The Limits of Tolerance, and Dorothy West's The Living is Easy.
Boston-born Dorothy West wrote about life in New England's African-American communities. Her book exposes turn-of-the-century tensions, not only between blacks and whites, but between upper-class black Brahmins and the newly freed slaves arriving from the South.
Tolerance, Dorothy West, and The Living is Easy on the next Storylines New England.